Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we're talking all manners of things and film. As always, I'm joined by my co-host and the man whose life is a dystopian screenplay, Martin McMahon. Martin, how are you, buddy?
Thanks very much, Tony. I've been working for it. I want it to be dystopian. I'm working towards it.
All you have to do is read your timeline, mate. It's just getting worse and worse. Quick housekeeping, guys. These podcasts rely on patrons. We do need people to support us. Look, it costs money to put it out into the world, and we do need your support. If you could go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, podcasts like this, like Reboot Republic and like Disturbing the Peace, they're all produced in this little room in Ballymun. We need your support. Please give us a dig out. But without further ado, and much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined in the Tortoise Shack by, I'm going to say physicist, multiple award-winning filmmaker and proud Lurcher owner, Lenny Abramson. Lenny, great. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast.
Absolute pleasure. Really happy to be here.
This has been a while in the making, because there's people who do end up in the couch understand that, you know, I kind of try to get people in and get them of interest, but I was like, I'd really love to talk to you. But how we spoke initially was about dogs.
It was. I think, yeah, I find I've made all sorts of connections in the real world and online through dogs. So yeah. In the park, I know, you know, I've been going to the same park for 20 years, I think, since my first dog turned up outside the flat I was living in, and basically I took her in. And I've met also people through there, but also online you find the unlikeliest connections. So I think we bonded over dogs.
There was an adoption going on, and we were trying to rehome a dog that I remember, and we were trying to see if where it was suitable, and there was a few recommendations, and I think that was how we bonded, all right. But it was just one of those, I suppose, from my point of view, how small social media has made the world now.
Yeah, and that's the good side of social media, and you do make these connections, and there are these ways into other people's lives that you may never have had the opportunity to know in the past. And that, I suppose, offsets the, at least to some extent, the really bad side of social media, which is, I don't know,
toxic.
We could talk about, yeah, very.
Well, first of all, I'd like to go back and start off by saying that Adam and Paul, okay? Obviously, it's a fantastic film. It's a national treasure. But actually, Martin loves to tell people. Go on, tell him, Martin.
Yeah, I met Tom.
Did you?
I did meet Tom. I was in hospital and I met Tom in hospital.
No, when Tom was sick.
When Tom was sick. I think I'm nearly sure it was Navan was the hospital.
Yeah, and I think you're right.
We had a couple of cigarettes together and we had a chat. And I told him at the time, I love Adam and Paul. I've always loved the movie. It's one of those that spoke to me of what I knew Dublin to be, you know, and what I knew this country to be. And it was lovely and he told me at the time he was dying of cancer, and and then a couple of years later, I was in the same boat myself. And I always remember talking to Tom. He was quite peaceful and quite,
Tom was, you know, and Mark, who wrote Adam and Paul and plays Adam, knew Tom had known him. They were incredibly close for many years. So
yeah,
knew Tom way better than I did. I really met him. I knew him in college. He was in college around the same time I was. And he was the actor, you know. Himself and Dominic West was around Trinity at that time as well. They were the two sort of standouts I remember. So I knew Tom on and off then, but really through Adam and Paul really met him. And he was, this very extraordinary man, in that he was a very private person for an actor, didn't run towards the limelight. And when we would go to festivals with the film, and this, we were all like overwhelmed by the fact that the film was having a life in Ireland and then outside of Ireland, you know. And so we went, I remember its premiere was in Berlin, which was an amazing experience for us all. And afterwards we were all hanging out, but Tom just trooped off himself, and he'd always do that.
Understated.
You know, though. Understated.
Yeah.
I think he won a Tony, Tom. Mm. And the first thing he did was try and change his name from Tom Murphy to Jordan Murphy for some reason. And we were saying, shouldn't you be capitalizing on the fact that you're now really successful? Yeah. But so it's great. I mean, a terrible loss, you know.
It was a very nice fella. I think for three or four evenings, there was a little sort of a
smoker's circle.
A smoker's place. And, you know, you chat when you're in these places.
Yeah.
So we had a couple of great chats. And, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning might only just be me and him having a cigarette, you know.
He liked to smoke to time.
He did, yeah.
But I remember him, so, you know, that was a brilliant time for all of us in the sense that I think the first time you do something, or I'd thought about making a film for so long, and I'd made a short, I'd made a few bits and pieces, and I had this kind of academic track thing going on at the same time, and I didn't really know what I was doing, but I'd gone off and I'd made this short film, gone off and come back, and having decided, yeah, I would try and be a filmmaker, and got lost a bit for a few years and made an awful lot of TV commercials, which it's a good thing and a bad thing for lots of different reasons.
You need to get paid.
You need to get paid. And also I needed to do it. You know, I came back with all sorts of ideas about making great films, and that froze me up for a while, you know, because I couldn't start. If you're only thinking about getting to some ultimate destination, that's very, you know, you have a very sort of purist idea of, it's very hard to begin. So I kind of hid in a flat for a while, trying to write and getting more and more kind of depressed. And then luckily started, I thought, some survival instinct said to me, you just got to get up and start doing things. And whatever they are, you should do them if they're connected to this filmmaking thing that you want to do. And so I pushed really hard to get into advertising. And because I have a good, because I'm a good talker and I can pitch, and I found I could actually move in that world of marketing pretty easily, because I could describe what I wanted to do, convince people that I was the person to do it.
Sold a vision.
So exactly, whether I fundamentally believed in it or not, which is a scary thing to discover about yourself. but I did it, and I with this great guy called Johnny Spears, who's a commercials producer. But we were working together for a few years, and I thought, right, now I've done that, and I've gained some confidence in doing that, I still really need to make a film. And Johnny met Mark O'Halloran, and Mark had all these different ideas, and one of them was Adam and Paul, which we started to develop together. He'd written these brilliant scenes.
And it was the dialogue. It was the dialogue in that movie that really, absolutely. I mean, it was
the pattern.
And then there were scenes in it, like the scene with the baby. That was
it was amazing to
That's
do.
The hairs on the back of your neck kind of stuff. And it showed a completely different side to both Adam and Paul.
Yeah. And also, I suppose the fact that they were, I think Mark's genius was to see these two characters, like he had moved up from Ennis and was living on Parnell Street. And he'd never seen, there wasn't a heroin problem there when he was growing up and where he came from. So suddenly he was seeing the world of addicts on the street, and he was just noticing these pairs of people, usually two people shambling along a street at a slightly different, in a slightly different time zone to everybody else.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is how we talked about it. Just the slowness of it.
Just a step outside.
And then suddenly you start to tune in and to sort of tune into that pattern of speaking and of living, and to see the sort of Beckettian possibilities in that. And I was this filmmaker who was obsessed with really, I love vaudeville. I've always loved that kind of, I love slapstick. I think there's a great depth and profundity in physical comedy. Because, you know, and I was an Laurel and Hardy fan. And so I remember seeing it and thinking, I really know how to do this dialogue. And Mark and I just having these incredibly brilliant chats where you'd feel like the fireworks were going off, because you could really see how this thing might feel. And then we just started, and it was because it was the first one, and because it was this kind of energy had built up behind the dam for so long.
Yeah.
I think in both of us of wanting to really do something, then the doing of it was such a lovely release. And, you know, then to have it actually strike a chord was amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I know we're going straight at Adam and Paul as if you've a lot of other work in that you've done since then, but there is a magical, you can still watch that.
Yes.
You can watch that. It's ageless. And I do really love that about that film. Whereas something like, you know, what Richard did,
it's a very particular period that it deals with. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a completely different,
and it's not a pleasure in the same way that Adam and Paul.
No, that made me angry, that movie, actually.
Yeah.
It made me angry.
But I'd love to hear how you felt about it, because for me to make something like that, I have to care about the central character.
I felt angry about it.
Yeah.
I felt very angry about it. I felt at the end of the movie, I asked myself, could I be that parent And I couldn't be that parent. No, I couldn't. I would stand by my child, but my child would take responsibility.
Mm. I would hope that I would be the same.
Mm. No, I know I would. I know I would. I've no doubt about it. I couldn't do that.
I always think, I know this is we're nearly always analysing Martin now, but you've a different life experience to everybody else.
Yeah,
in the room.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when I get annoyed about something, Martin kind of tells me to calm down because, well, you know, are you going to die is his benchmark. You know,
yeah. So, did you get up this morning? Okay, that's a plus.
That's a plus.
That's
yeah,
a win.
That's,
you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I totally get that. I mean, I've that feeling. If you've never had to, are you brave or would you crumble? You know, given like politically what's happening now, and you look at, you know, I grew up with a shadow of all sorts of dark things that were in my family's past, you know, and thinking, well, what sort of courage would I've had?
Hmm.
You know, and you read memoir and you read history and you think of what people have had the capacity to do. I don't know whether I would be brave or not in a situation where to just not do it would be so much easier.
I suppose I've gone further than I thought I could possibly go. I've endured more than I possibly thought I could ever endure. So yeah, I can say that there is more there than I would think is there, or then I would credit myself for being there. I mean, there were situations where it was just so much easier to give up. I just kept going. So, yeah, I do see it in me that, yeah, there is a sort of a rod.
That's a really great thing to know about yourself, I think, because that's always obsessed me. I mean, I remember in terms of the sort of work that I've always responded to, like, for example, remember reading Lord Jim or stories about people. Richard is really a story about a person who thinks they know who they are,
yes,
who thinks they have all sorts of qualities and strengths and discovers that they're totally empty ultimately. Mm-hmm. And my great fear is that I am that person. So hence I continually go back to these moments of the idea of not knowing yourself or of being, so even something like in Frank where the John character is basically totally deluded.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm fascinated by those characters because I think my great fear is that I am one. And God knows, but that certainly occupies me. That fear occupies me.
Yeah. I think we all come across testing times in different realms. And when you do, you begin to know yourself.
Yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
begin to know.
Yeah.
You're never going to know in the ordinary day to day where you are. But when something really tests you, then you do learn who you are.
Yeah, yeah.
You absolutely do learn.
It's interesting though, because you referenced, you know, knowing about your family history. I mean, you were raised in Judaism, that this was you're not generations ago. We talk about it all the time, and it's a fascination of me and myself and Martin were talking about it only last week. I said how this schism and Christianity, Judaism, and then the history, and not too far back, and we see these awful events now starting to creep back into mainstream things where the othering is becoming more comfortable and the
and actually nobody, I mean the thing about the current the I mean, you know, it's the same pattern and you see it repeating itself, and it is, you know, I spent a lot of time early on in my life being very drawn to a kind of proper, you know, philosophically left-wing position, and so read Marx and still think there's tremendous depth of analysis. If you want to understand what's happening, the left perspective is always the correct one, I think, you know, in terms of analysis. But in terms of the future, in terms of how we get to where need to get to, I think I've become less convinced of that idea that I used to dismiss the psychological explanations of things in favor of the sociological or the, you know, the idea that
people are responding to incentives.
It's the conditions around you. It's the, you know, being determines consciousness, or, you know, it's the social structures, and the political structures and the class structures are the things that make people feel and do as they feel and do. But actually there is a human nature as well. And it does contain, all of us contain this capacity for, or at least most of us, there are saints and there are devils, very few of them. Most of us are in the middle, and most of us are capable of doing terrible things. And that's what history, I think, shows us. And so when you look again at that happening, it's just, you know, it's so dispiriting, especially after the convulsions of the 20th century, where you think maybe we would have learned, you know.
I kind of think living memory has something to do with it. I think the fact that we are now at the stage that there is nobody left alive who fought.
Yeah.
I think that living memory is gone. And I think once the living memory is gone, they start to romanticize.
Yeah.
Again, and then you have this upswell, and you just, I'm like you, I just see this loop. I see this.
And is
loop.
There any way of, you know, do you need a sort of, that not need, I mean, is there, is it, is the metaphor, is the analogy with a sort of physical illness? You know, if you eat something and you get food poisoning.
Yeah.
The nausea rises and falls, and it rises, and then you throw, just when you think it can't get any worse, there's this kind of, you throw up and then you feel sort of, your head clears and you feel normal again.
Yeah.
And you, and after the convulsion of the Second World War and all those dead and all that kind of destruction, it's like people sort of shook off, woke up with this terrible hangover from all this nationalism and imperialism and, you know, like that kind of that all the darkness,
xenophobia. We can list it off,
and then say, okay, what we should really do is, you know, set up some structures. It's like putting the picture of your really fat self on the fridge, so you don't go back for more food. Can we set things up that will remind us not to? You know, what structures can we build that will stop that?
Well, I mean, even if we look even on a smaller scale at Brexit, and Brexit is just simply this whole World War II Biggles sort of stuff.
Absolutely.
And it's, you know, it's ridiculous.
It's so manifestly ridiculous. And in order to sort of go with it, you have to let go of reality. I mean, the reason why no deal Brexit appeals to people is because it's a complete and utter sort of unknowable black box. As soon as you try and specify what sort of a Brexit you might want, you're faced with the irrefutable realization that it's going to be worse than where you are now.
Yes.
So instead, let's just fantasize ourselves into this kind of imaginary kind of phase, which can be anything you want it to be because it's not real. And we can see that happening.
But I often quote Arundhati Roy and her phrase about lifestyle wars as well. And a lot of it is lifestyle wars. A lot of it is us in the West not understanding that, you know, this hard fought and hard won peace that we've had has been built on a global
absolutely
neoliberal agenda.
I mean, and the seeds of its destruction have been present since even, it's not like there was a golden era.
No.
After the war, there were some attempts in some parts of the world to make life more tolerable for people, sometimes because the people in charge recognized that if they didn't, revolution was possible.
It
was a very self-interested decision to like, well, let's you know, that was where the NHS came from, and all sorts of progressive movements. Some of the welfare. But that was, of course, in the context of a global order, which was crushing huge numbers of people, vast majority of people in the world. So, yeah, I try not to. I mean, it's very hard to think about all this without just becoming deeply pessimistic.
I think that's the key phrase, though. It's about turning that into how is there hope? How do we, in our own politics? I know you can be outspoken on social media about certain issues, and we talk in here all the time about housing, health, education.
Yeah.
But we do also try to focus on solutions, and we try to say, well, look, you know, there is a politics of hope, even if currently it's hard to sometimes see it.
Yeah.
I suppose my question is, like, you know, to you is where do you see the right, where the activism should come from?
Yeah. There? I mean, you know, sometimes when I'm feeling dark about it, which is most of the time, and actually I will say that because, and this is just, to be, you know, you got to be honest with yourself. The kind of the fatalistic kind of bleakness is a luxury as well, and it is a luxury that people like me particularly have available to us, because my life is quite, you know, I'm in a very good position given the, you know, in the current order of things.
Yeah.
I'm you know, relatively secure. And I benefit from the way things are at the moment. But I can, you know, my option is to happily benefit, be safe and secure, but feel a bit miserable. That's not acceptable, right? But just to finish the idea, when I'm feeling bleak about it, the only thing I think about, say somebody like me, what can you do? And I was joking with somebody recently, you start thinking about it like, you know, the monks in the dark ages, like, go into your tower, try and preserve something of the ideas of enlightenment, of decency, of kindness or whatever, and just keep that light burning while the world, you know, and hope that there's a few little bits of it left to rebuild afterwards. You know, this sort of the sci-fi, you know, you're talking about dystopian idea of it, is that maybe some people will hang in there, and there'll be something left at the end of all this awfulness.
What you do, though, is you have a platform to build hope and the movies have always been an escape for people.
Yeah.
Always been an escape for people. So you're in an ideal position to.
I agree. I think that's the responsibility, how do I make things which aren't escapist in the sense that they're not to switch you off,
but they
somehow create a sense of opening up a space for empathy, for deep empathy between human beings. That's the only thing I can think of doing.
Well, I remember the first time I think I ever added you on Twitter was I was in the lighthouse and I'd watching Room, and I tried to, no spoilers, but I'm sure everybody has seen it, but in the middle of this certain scene, I decided I had to leave. And my wife kept pulling me back and saying, no, please sit down. And I think I sent you a message and I said, if I see you now, I'll punch you in the gut. and you replied, and I think it was something along the lines of, that's kind of what we were going for, you know. And I was just remember thinking, I literally wanted to leave.
Yeah.
I said, I'm going. I can't.
But it is ultimately a positive.
Yes,
it is.
It's a positive. Emma's novel is a positive thing, which says you can. And actually, I think what her novel says, even in really, really dreadful circumstances, there are bits of humanity that can hold, and that you know, life can still exist. Now, the thing is, I think that we have to operate on that basis. I think there are some circumstances which are so dreadful that it almost, you know, and the industrialized sort of brutalization of people that can happen. You can. I mean, that's the Orwellian idea of the. I mean, that's what's why that novel is so absolutely dreadful.
Yeah,
but the difference, or the you know, there's huge similarities to many, many women in Ireland who are literally raising their children in a room.
Yes, absolutely.
It's always on my mind. It's always on my mind.
And parenting somebody in a situation where the world around you is. You want to protect them for that period of time from the reality. And at the same time, you have the responsibility to bring them into that reality in some way that allows them to live and hopefully allows them to, you know, find love themselves and have a life which they can value. That's a thing which all parents have to struggle with. And in the circumstances, I mean, I thought Paddy's film Rosie was brilliant in that regard. And just how people are so extraordinarily courageous in their ability to give their children a childhood, even in circumstances which are dreadful. But yeah, and right now in the housing situation in Ireland, it's obscene that so many children are being raised in circumstances.
It is obscene. I mean, there isn't, you can't put a spin on it. You can't optimism it. It's awful.
3,778 children in emergency accommodation.
But there's more, Tony, that aren't.
Oh, I know that. We're reclassifying and recategorizing and all. But I there's a hub not far from here, and I think I said this over the weekend, painted outside in the car parking space, it says set down only.
I saw that. I just thought that's for goods.
And that's exactly how I felt. I was out for my run, and I went by,
I read that, yeah.
Yeah, and this has become an element of whereby it's successfully the state has managed to normalize that.
I know, but this is the thing. There's two things that strike me about that. One is that this is a problem that is entirely soluble.
Yeah,
this could be dealt with. There is no issue there at all.
No,
and actually, in a way, You know, so I remember somebody saying to me years ago, or, you know, about the States and going, why are there homeless people in a rich country? And you imagine you've got a sort of in your fantasy, you think, well, Democratic president will go, well, we don't think this is a good idea. Mm. And let's assume as well, let's not assume malice because that's too easy. Mm-hmm. Let's assume like the structural. Let's look at it structurally and go, okay, so let's assume this person comes into power and they're generally, you know, well disposed towards people not suffering unnecessarily. Yeah. Why don't they just go and solve it? And I think the answer is that it would be dangerous from a market point of view to look like you were not hard nosed about stuff like that.
Perfectly,
it would be
perfectly phrased.
You know, and so therefore you look at it now and you go, we have to ask. It is a perfect way to understand our political reality to say, why is it easier to leave 3,778
children,
kids in emergency accommodation plus all the circles around that than it is to solve it, than it is to fix it? Why is it not being fixed? And the only way you can put pressure on that is through by activism, by protest and by political movements which oppose it. But the other thing is that it isn't that they call it the Overton window, don't they?
Yes,
whatever.
It's
just, you know, it's so easy. Like you just drift and centrist parties will always end up. They never move left. No, they always drift, move right.
They're captured.
You know, and the thing is, I don't know what the answer to that is because.
But kiss right, punch left.
Yeah.
Can I come in on that and just say one thing, which is very revealing, was our own Taoiseach's comments over the weekend about people in direct provision.
Oh.
They
can go back.
They can just leave. They can just go. And he made a point then about, you know, sure, aren't we providing it by definition, what we're providing shelter and food? And then we talk about, and I want to go back down to looking right here on this, Martin, because the cost of that, someone was estimating out, I saw Massey were estimating out on some of these cases, they were paying up to 100 euro per night for some of these accommodations. There's over 7,000 people, they reckon, in this system. And we have the state's own reports that says for example, for every HAP tenancy in Dublin, they can afford to build two affordable homes on state land.
Yeah.
But they will refuse to do that, as we've seen with O'Devany Gardens, where they're going to make 67 million in profit in state land. So you're right, Lenny. Yeah. It is a market-driven, and they're saying it's trickle-down economics, but it's really we're just there. Someone's pissing against the urinal and we're hoping some splashback will hit
us. Yeah, no. I mean, the trickle-down thing since Reagan has been just comprehensively dismantled as an idea. You know, the other thing is people talk about these market realities. You know, what people choose to believe is a reality versus a fantasy is entirely kind of contingent on where they are on the political spectrum.
Yes.
You know, it is perfectly reasonable to say, actually, the reality is it is unacceptable to have children in emergency accommodation and people in direct provision under these circumstances, especially where direct provision is hugely profitable for private companies. Yep. I mean,
it's a for-profit business.
And I was involved and have been involved with and was friends with some people who were in that situation actually pre the current direct provision regime when it was not as bad and it was still absolutely awful. And it's so odd now because you have this kind of, I don't know, this situation where, like, I was trying to think about how people do accommodate themselves to the status quo is such an interesting, there's such a long history of writing about this. My wife's Polish and I remember through her reading this, Czesław Miłosz, who is this brilliant essayist and poet, but he wrote this book called The Captive Mind, which is a brilliant study of what happened in amongst the intellectuals that he knew in Poland post-war and how people accommodated themselves to the dominant ideology and how that process works. Mm. And you see it in every area. Like I'm fascinated, like as somebody who would like to think that they want to make films which are challenging. Mm. You sit in rooms all the time. You go to the States and I spend a bit of time there and you're pitching ideas and or talking about what you want to do. And as you talk about it, you can feel the temperature in the room change. Mm. So if you talk about something which is more towards the kind of, you know, broader appeal, the temperature in the room will warm up. If you talk about something which is more challenging and more difficult, the temperature will cool down. Unless you're very aware of that, people like to be liked. People like to be responded to positively. People like it when other people like them.
Mental stroking.
Mental stroking. So you find yourself, if you're not aware of it, just beginning to move in the direction that the heat gradient, the popularity gradient, the acceptance gradient. And that process is so kind of, so insidious, because you don't really notice it happening, but gradually everything starts to shift. And what used to be considered a mainstream idea now seems like it's way on the left. And
it's radical.
You know, it's radical. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It is. And the world has shifted. And we also know that with the shift, there will eventually be an adjustment again. It's not permanent. This is elastic. It stretches out. It stretches back.
Yeah.
And, you know, the stretch back is never easy.
No. And also, I suppose we kind of feel like that what we were talking about earlier on, the convulsive theory of history, that there'll be these convulsions. Well, that's the terrifying thing. Do we need another kind of local in the West catastrophe? There are catastrophes happening all around the world all the time. But in terms of where the real forces are at work in the world globally, do we need another we don't need is the wrong word, but is that what it takes for people to realize they have to sort of...
Kind of back to the living memory thing again.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
What are you working on now?
So I'm working on two different projects. Well, sort of a few different projects. I've been working on Sally Rooney's... I've done another adaptation, and I'm going to stop for a while.
Yeah.
Because I write as well, and I'm also working with writers on original ideas. But so I'm making Normal People, which is this novel that Sally Rooney wrote, which is set in Sligo in Dublin, two young Irish people. And it's, for me, it's a positive. I just felt like I absolutely needed to do something which was about, we're talking about hope, but this is it's a beautiful love story about these two young people discovering each other. It's very positive. It's positive about sex. It's positive about youth. It's positive about the capacity of people to really have profound, life-changing experiences with each other. And I've been privileged to work with two really brilliant young actors and an ensemble cast of largely young Irish actors shooting in Ireland, being able to be here with my family. So I've been doing that, and it's for the BBC, but it's entirely an Irish production, and it'll be for the Hulu in the States. So that'll come out in the spring, I think. And then I'm working on, so a few disparate projects, but they all sort of speak to things that I'm really concerned about. I'm working with Mark O'Halloran again, which is brilliant, on something that we've talked about for more than 10 years, which is a film about set in Ennis, where Mark grew up, in the early 80s. And it's a story about a family. And again, it's a kind of, there's a depth of positivity in it, I think, but totally unsentimental. I feel just there's a drive in me to in an attempt to say, to value the things that should be valued. So you have a choice sometimes in making, which is to point to the threats to that, and also to celebrate what is valuable in human life. It's a beautiful coming of age story set around the time of the hunger strikers and over a year in Ennis. And it's a period I'm really interested in Ireland in the early 80s, which I remember, like, it's when I kind of grew up, or I grew up in the 70s, but... Yeah, and the early 80s.
Your consciousness was there in that period.
Definitely.
I think there's a year between us, so I think it's probably the same.
Yeah, 66, I was born. Yeah,
68. So,
there you go.
Yeah.
And it was a good year to be born. The revolutionary year.
And we turned out to be very handsome guys.
We did. Not a lot of hair. Something in the air. Which have a conspiracy theory about.
Yeah,
like,
nothing grows on a busy street. That's we just thought about things a lot more.
Exactly. So the other thing I'm working on is, I came across this story, and for me it often starts with character, just a character. And there's a boxer called Emil Griffith, who boxed in the 1950s and 60s and into the 70s in the States. He was from the Caribbean, but he moved when he was about 12, 13 to New York. Poor kid, black kid, growing up in Harlem. And he was very interesting because he was gay.
Yeah.
He was very interested in fashion. He wanted to work in fashion, and he got a job in a hat-making factory in the garment district in the States, in New York in the 50s. but he was also just this incredible physical specimen. And his boss was a boxing fanatic and said to him, would you ever think about boxing? And he said, not really, but I'll do, you know, he was a very biddable guy. Anyway, he became welterweight champion and lived this double life between that world and the world of the sort of underground gay scene in the States. And so it's about masculinity in a way. But it's also about, I suppose, about race. And it's primarily just about this particular character who, he's a sort of character that fascinates me in that he's, Griffith himself was very, like, as I say, very biddable, wanted to be liked. Again, thing that I constantly go back to. Very chatty and social, but in a way, in a deep way, internally very guarded, because I suppose he had to be. And, you know.
Well, in that era, like we talk about, imagine it, these days we talk about intersectionality.
I mean, he was, yeah, he was an immigrant. He was living in a deeply racially segregated world, and he was gay.
Yeah.
And he was also suddenly put in the spotlight. So all the fractures, potential, all the sort of fault lines there were put under massive pressure.
Walking on eggshells.
Exactly. And in drama, what you're looking for a lot of the time are situations which put characters under huge pressure, because that's where you see what they're built out of. It's like those machines that, that like test parts by crushing them, you know?
The IKEA chair.
Exactly. How many people can sit on it?
You spoke about despair earlier, but it's very clear for me. You love what you do.
Yeah.
You love it.
Yes. And it's my kind of, and I'm really lucky, because I need that motion. You know, it is odd for me, but there is a kind of fear when it stops that I don't quite know how to sustain.
Musical chairs.
It isn't it?
Without a seat.
You're like, exactly. And I need to have that. Like in the work itself, which can sometimes be incredibly hard, like from a kind of hours point of view and from pressure point of view. You know, when you're shooting, I always think when I'm shooting, God, why do I do this? It's really, you know, and it's not, I'm not saving anybody's life and nobody's going to die on the table in front of me or anything. But in terms of like the pressure of the day and the kind of sense of potential failure all the time, it's quite intense. But I do love it, and I do love ideas, and it is an opportunity to think about things and explore worlds. It's such a privilege, you know. So if the Emil Griffith film happens, I get to go and try and create Times Square in the 1950s. Yeah. Like, it's an amazing thing to be able to
magic,
do.
Really.
And work with, go and meet actors and find a young, because he was, like he was world champion in his early 20s, to find somebody to work with and to get into their life and find ways of making their life make sense in terms of the character's life. It's an amazing ability. It's an amazing capacity in your life to have that space that you can step into. And I never feel very lucky to be doing that.
We're kind of lucky to have you in this country, aren't we? We are. Go on, in honesty, we are.
I'll let you say that, Mark. I'll sit here and polish my head.
But no, you're in here chatting with us, podcast, and we can talk about our local things.
Yeah.
What you do is really, really special. There are a lot of people who'd love to make movies. There are less still who do make movies, and even fewer still who make movies that speak to people.
I am aware of that, and sometimes I'm involved in like projects where I mentor people or do, and there's brilliant schemes. And I had two brilliant people out on Normal People on the set, and they've been in post as well. And in pre-production, try and get, you know, do all that. But what I was reading statistics are really, you know, the BFI in Britain put out statistics about for every 100 people who make one film, like a film where there's some funding you know, 10 people will make a second.
Okay.
3 will make a third. And then it goes to less than 1 very quickly. So it's not I'm very aware of the fact that it's very, you need a lot of luck, and you also need to, like I didn't.
Resilience.
Then. Yeah. You need resilience and stubbornness and all that. And there are some brilliant people here in Ireland it's really changed. I mean, when I started out, myself and Ed Guiney, who I still work you know, we still worked together.
That was your company,
we were 15 years old when we started talking about making films together. And I've known Stephen Renix, who's the composer that does everything that I've done. We were in, was it third class together? Well, we were nine when we met. So I still work with people I've known all my life. But when we started and made a short called Three Joes, I think there was only one other short made that year.
Right.
And no features. And you look at it now and there really is a pretty amazing, like compared to the size of the country, there are a lot of really good storytellers and filmmakers whose films have been seen internationally and at festivals and mean a lot to Irish audiences. Because again, I remember when somebody would say, oh, it's an Irish film.
Mm.
As you know, that was that was the end of this conversation about whether you'd go and see it or not.
Okay, but I think it's we've spoken to young filmmakers in here as well, and you know the new music with Cara Vialli is out, I think, in Cork.
Shortly.
You think you see these people, and I you kind of envy them as well because while they're at the beginning, they're also chasing that dream.
Yeah,
and it's having that energy, that enthusiasm. I suppose, you know, when I look back, and I know I opened by calling you a physicist, but that was, and you had a little laugh, but you know, that was where you were in Trinity.
I did physics and then I had this odd journey and I feel like I'm a late bloomer generally. I had kids late. Everything is a bit late. And, I was always interested in things. I read a lot and I was interested in ideas as a kid. And I was really interested, well, I thought I was interested in physics because I'd read, sort of, you know, books about it and it sounded incredibly mind-blowing and fascinating and I was quite good at maths and physics in school, but I was also interested in novels and, you know, films and everything. But I did go in to study physics and I did it for 2 years, but then I changed to philosophy. Now, here's the lucky part for me, which is that I came from a background where I could afford to do that. You know, and I'm totally aware of that. And actually, when I got a scholarship pretty quick and I did... Then I went to the States to do more philosophy and that was a scholarship. But I'd already started messing with film at that point. And that was the two things battling away from me. But when I came back and I was kind of broke, I did have help from my parents. And I don't know whether that was, maybe I would have been faster in a weird way if I hadn't. I might have just not been able to sit on my arse for those few years. Admittedly broke, but not so broke that I had to like stop doing what I was doing.
Yeah. Well, it was nice to have the opportunity. I mean, it has worked really well. And now you're in the sort of the, I know you're not in it for charity, but you give back through the films.
Yes.
You know, everybody has to make a living. We all understand that.
Yeah.
But you could just do, you know, rom-coms.
Yeah, I could. And I have had opportunities to do big projects, big films, and I've never taken them. You do learn about yourself. You were saying that you learn through those moments of terrible adversity. I suppose the only equivalent, it's nothing like what you're talking about. The equivalent for me would be, it's very easy as a young filmmaker that nobody gives a shit about to say, oh, if the phone rang and I was offered a big franchise film, I told them I wouldn't be interested. You know, I'm interested in something else.
Here's the Marvel Universe.
Exactly. Now, you only know whether you really believe that if it actually
happens.
Turn
it down,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so as you get on, I do realize that I just don't, you know what you're good at sort of as well. But I do think that there is a part of me that I think, and I keep thinking about it, that I do want to make some much more left field films. And again, it's very easy to keep putting that off because as the opportunities continue to come, like if I can fund the Emil Griffith film now, which we have a good chance of doing because of the track record.
Yeah.
Very hard not to make that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in 10 years' time, maybe I won't be able to get that one made.
Yeah.
And then there's a really interesting American Civil War project as well, which is about America and about, it's a female protagonist, about a woman who disguises herself as a man to fight in the Civil War. It's a novel. It's based on a great novel called Never Home.
There's a movie out at the moment.
That's right.
I was watching it.
Yeah. I haven't seen it.
Very interesting.
Deliberately don't want to watch it.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
But those projects are hard because they're historical and they're expensive. And both of those films, the Emil Griffith and the Civil War film, are difficult because the messages are not straightforward.
No.
Emil's film does not end, the story of Emil does not end with him, raising his fist in, it's a very complicated story of a character, and the Civil War film is a film about, it's an anti-war film, it's not a fun ride.
Yeah.
But I do think I need to also concentrate somewhat on really more difficult films, films that the people that I make, you know, the funders of the bigger ones really won't be interested in. Yeah.
But you need to make that to make the other as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, we all have a trade-off.
Exactly.
And you know, the work will speak for itself. They're fantastic stories. I was aware of the Emil story. And you know, as soon as you said his name, it all triggered with me. And I won't go into it in much detail, but it is an amazing, incredible story.
Yeah. Yeah.
The last thing I just go, we've spoken about the work, but you're very passionate, I know, about education. You're very passionate about, you were involved in the Educate Together movement.
Yeah.
What triggered that for you?
Well, again, it's that kind of thing where on the one hand, you're looking at these massive political and economic and social movements, and you're going, and changes, and you're thinking, what can I possibly do about that? It just seems so overwhelming. That's the thing about social media as well. It's just, it's a big, huge rush of, cortisol every morning when you read the latest outrages. But then on the other hand, you're just looking at your own life and thinking, well, my kids are in an Educate Together school. I didn't know much about the movement until that happened. And I just really like the ethos.
Yeah.
And I also think that if you're, you know, one of the areas in which you can make the most difference, I think, socially, is in education and early education particularly. Because I think, especially, you know, what I love about the Educate Together schools is they're very integrated in terms of people from different backgrounds, people from immigrant communities, in parts of the country where that was very difficult for people from other cultures to find a school when they come here, were welcomed into the Educate Together movement. Places like Balbriggan are really interesting and how that worked out there. That's such an amazing school.
Mm.
And so I tweeted something. It's Twitter. There you go. Mm. I tweeted something about the kids and Educate Together, and Educate Together got in touch and said, we saw you said something nice about us. So you're interested in learning more. So I said, yeah. And I went out and I went to that. A couple of different schools. I talked to head teachers, talked to pupils and students from different countries, different cultures, different backgrounds. And the point is, if you can create something like a harmonious community of kids of that age, which you totally can, because kids of that age are so open, then the possibility of real social cohesion and a sense of solidarity between people is so much more. Once people are in their bunkers, older people are in their bunkers, it's very hard to get them out of it. But the one thing you learn about what's happening, why things have gone so wrong, I think, is that with policies of austerity, with lack of kind of with the sort of very polarized British media. Look at Britain. Look at the media. Look at the tabloids over the years. The xenophobia, the anti-immigrant, the use of those tropes to rile up people's bases. Mm. You just end up with this completely broken society. And once you have that, once you have those divisions, It's so easy for populists and authoritarians to make use of that.
Divide and rule.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
absolutely. And it goes on here all the time.
It goes on all the time. And we think we're immune, I think. Some of us, some people think we're immune to the really bad stuff. And we're absolutely not.
No, it's creeping.
It's creeping. You can see it. And there's a lot of stuff from the center which says, oh, just ignore these people. You're giving them too much oxygen. And actually, I'd agree with ignoring them if you're in the media.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, they don't.
No.
we point it out quite a bit.
You do. Yeah. And we all know the sort of the world we're talking about.
Well, unfortunately, that is, we spoke about the British tabloid media. There is an element of Irish tabloidism.
Yes.
In
the broadcast media,
media. And,
yeah.
And it is purely for that
clickbait,
income-generating outrage.
Yeah.
You know, and unfortunately, we have to be more cognizant of it. And that's another thing I've seen about the Educate Together ethos you mentioned, is that there's an element of almost doing so a media training, going, if you're reading this, why is it being framed like this?
Yeah.
What is the context of it?
who was putting it out into the world.
Yeah, just exactly. Try and teach people to be critical about what they read. I mean, the terrible thing is we're in danger of falling off all sorts of cliffs.
Yeah.
You know, if you become sort of hypercritical, then you end up in the kind of conspiracy nut world.
You're looking at him.
No. I walk that line.
No, you do. You succeed. Yeah, I walk that line. You haven't yet.
No. I couldn't get dragged into conspiracy.
Because things are much more boring than the conspiracy theories. It's much more obvious. All you need is greed and
generally it's idiocy and greed.
Idiocy and greed. You don't need the Illuminati.
No.
It's whenever anybody says the word globalist or cabal,
you are so next door to good old fashioned anti-Semitism. As soon as you hear globalist, that is not next door.
There are people who don't understand the historical echo of that, and you're like, why are you repeating that? That is literally saying the Rothschilds are
oh no, the Soros.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Soros is the Rothschild.
I got accused
Rothschild
over the weekend of being.
Are you a Soros shill?
Yeah, and I do play on it once a month.
Well, as long as I get
Soros
the check.
My Soros check is late this month.
Yeah, I know.
As long as I keep getting those checks, it's
fine. I know. We'll keep doing the work.
Lenny, thank you so much for coming in. It's been a real pleasure to have a chat with you.
Total pleasure.
And I'm delighted to see that you are hyper normal. You're just a hyper normal person.
Apparently, I'm very unusually normal. I'm told by the producers that I've worked with. So I always take that as a compliment.
Right. Yeah. I just say one thing. You mentioned the ethos of the schools. You also mentioned what appeals to you in your films. It strikes me that it's your values that drive you.
Yeah.
And I think that is a real credit to you.
Thank you.
That comes across in meeting you, and it comes across in the work you produce. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much to both of you, and best of luck with the rest of the podcast.
Okay, folks, housekeeping again. Look, tortoiseshack.ie, get on there. You can look at all the previous pods, and there are some really, really great pods there. I recommend Simon McGarr at the current moment in time. But look, we need patrons. Come on, be a patron. Help us fund these podcasts, and we'll just bring you more of what you like. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.